Behind every life transformed by medicine is a story, one that often begins with an investigator with a fresh idea, an idea that turns into a study and that ultimately advances patient care. Only innovation can truly help our patients live longer, healthier lives. Hello, my name is Dr. Kristen Siamber, and I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. This is the monthly podcast of ACRU, the Cancer Research Network, whose mission is to establish the next level study for cancer research across the major disease groups. In this podcast, we want to hear the stories behind the innovative ideas and listen to the unique journeys of our researchers. Listen in as we explore the people and ideas of today's leading translational research. Welcome to the ACRU Transformative Research Podcast. My name is Dr. Kristen Siamber, and I'm excited to host this episode as we explore the stories and innovation of today's leading translational research. Our special guest today is Dr. Matthew P. Goetz. Dr. Goetz is director of the Mayo Clinic Breast Cancer SPORE, or Specialized Program of Research Excellence. He also co-leads the Women's Cancer Program at the Mayo Clinic and co-chairs the Breast Cancer Disease Oriented Group at the Mayo Clinic. He is the Erwin K. Haub Family Professor of Cancer Research, honoring Richard F. Emslander, MD. A notable area of Dr. Goetz's focus has been the pharmacogenetics of tamoxifen. Out of this work, and in collaboration with the Developmental Therapeutics Program of the NCI, Dr. Goetz has led a team of investigators in the development of a novel formulation of endoxifen hydrochloride for the treatment of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Dr. Goetz's additional focus is on estrogen receptor positive breast cancer and the development of novel therapeutics for endocrine resistant breast cancer. His laboratory and clinical work is funded by the NIH. Dr. Goetz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Kristen.
So I wanted to get started on this episode with talking a little bit about some of the research that you've done, and probably most recently, at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium in December, you presented a paper and a study looking at the rates of omission of endocrine therapy for women with HER2-positive and ER-positive breast cancer and the effect of that on survival. Can you tell us a little bit about that study and what surprised you as you did it?
Sure. So this was actually something that many people are or may be familiar with, and this is the National Cancer Database, or the NCDB, which is a tool that's available for researchers to be able to look at clinical research questions. And it really gets into, of course, some of the granularity of some of the, people use this term relatively loosely, but real world data. So what's actually happening out in the community as it relates to practice patterns and also outcomes. So one of the things that we were interested in was looking at the role of chemotherapy response to women who had a diagnosis of ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. And as we were looking at that, many patients actually are treated with neoadjuvant chemotherapy out in the community. And we stumbled upon this. We stumbled upon it because I was asking the statistician that I work with, Tanya Hoskin, because she had pointed out to me that she had information about whether patients were taking endocrine therapy. And I said, well, you really don't have information on this, do you? And she said, well, we don't have information on whether they were adherent to it, because obviously those data are difficult to get. But we do have data, she said, on whether they actually start the therapy. And I said, well, that's going to be easy. Everybody starts therapy. And she said, no, she said, that's not the case. And so this really started then with, we started framing the questions. And first of all, we looked at this, what I would call is a very, very high risk group of patients. So these are patients where clinician has essentially recommended the patient to receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So the patient received it. And then from the NCDB, we actually know information about whether or not they responded to chemotherapy. And so response in this situation is PCR. PCR stands for complete pathological response. And we looked at two groups of patients. we looked at patients that had neoadjuvant chemotherapy that had ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer. We also looked at the more common group, and this is the group of patients that had ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. And then what we did, we actually looked at the outcomes of patients. Well, stepping back, we actually first looked at the issue of, are patients omitting endocrine therapy or not? And then we also then asked the question of, what is the consequence of whether or not, you know, you omit endocrine therapy? So that's really where we started in terms of this question.
I think that's, you bring up a really interesting point in terms of, how do we know that the therapies we recommend are actually being taken by patients, and what is that effect? So, and as you mentioned, it can be really hard to get that data. I think about that a lot with colon cancer as we move to more oral chemotherapeutics, and wondering also if patients are upfront with us in telling us whether they're taking it or not. So that's a really interesting and real world sort of application in terms of something important to study. So what did you find?
So this is a large number of patients that we were studying. So there was about not quite a little over 34,000 patients who were treated with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So breast cancer is a common cancer, but this is actually a more select group of patients, right? Because they're very high risk, they have high risk features. And what we found was that overall, about 15 or 16% of patients actually never got adjuvant endocrine therapy. And what we found, which was really quite interesting, was that if you were ER positive, HER2 negative, that almost all of those patients received adjuvant endocrine therapy. Now, it was still a substantial number that didn't. It was about 11% or so of patients did not receive, never got adjuvant endocrine therapy. But if you had a diagnosis of ER positive, HER2 positive breast cancer, it was close to 40% of patients Wow. never got it. So the next thing we asked the question was, well, maybe response to therapy is affecting the decision or not to use therapy. So for example, there is this view is that if you have a PCR, well, all my cancer is gone and I don't have to do anything else. I'm done. And in fact, that's actually what we found is that you look at patients who had a pathological and complete response to therapy, clinicians and patients were making decisions essentially to not start endocrine therapy based on that. So if you had residual disease after you know all that chemotherapy, you're more likely then for the clinician and the patient to actually start endocrine therapy. Whereas if you had residual disease, we know, of course, those patients are at higher risk for recurrence. The patients were more likely to start endocrine therapy. But what was quite interesting was that in this group, very high risk group of patients, so you get all this chemotherapy, you have residual disease, there were still about 10% of patients who had ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer who never started endocrine therapy. And then if we look at this group of patients that are ER positive, HER2 positive, and they had residual disease, it's actually over 30% of patients that never started it. And so this was really stunning to me. So this has nothing to do with, well, once you started, did you stay on it? This is just saying, did you even start it? And so it's a substantial number of patients that haven't started it. And then finally, we just asked the question, we had asked the very hard question of a hard endpoint, which NCDB it records, which is death. Does it make a difference for death? And the answer is, yes, it does. So if you don't take endocrine therapy, you have about a 75% higher risk of death if you're ER positive, HER2 negative. But interestingly, if you're ER positive, HER2 positive, you still have a higher risk of death. And it's about a 60 to 70% higher risk of death. So I think that what's happening here is quite interesting is that, first of all, there's a lot of variability about in terms of who's starting this therapy. And I'm not sure why. We don't completely understand all the factors. We're looking into that right now. But I think suffice it to say, the take-home point is that in real world, if people are not taking their therapy, they're not even starting it. And it has real public health consequences, higher rates of death if you don't take the drugs.
Well, that's a really powerful conclusion. And I think one that that will be interesting to see kind of how you continue to study. I think about it kind of in an analogous way for my colon cancer patients, for instance. I spend so much time in the post-op setting when patients have had, say, a colon resection for an early stage colon cancer, and they say, oh, the surgeon said they got it all, so I'm good. I shouldn't need any adjuvant chemotherapy. And so there's really a lot of education, I think, that has to happen to make sure that they understand the nuances between macroscopic and microscopic disease, and especially if the decision to start endocrine therapy has such an impact on survival. So that's really, it sounds like really important work.
I think the thing that is, to me, is most fascinating, of course, is that, and this is what I tell my patients routinely, is that when we give neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and we do a lot of this in breast cancer for higher risk patients. And one of the things that we do know, of course, is that if you have residual disease in the breast, that's your window into what's happening in the microscopic liver, lung, or bones. And so if you have residual disease in the breast and lymph nodes, you have a much higher risk for distant recurrence within 3 to 5 years. But I think that what happens, and there's this view, and maybe you can comment on this as well, Kristen, but there's this view is that, at least in breast cancer, where we have sort of this combination of IV chemotherapy and then we give an oral targeted therapy, let's say, there's this view that the most important thing is those drugs that make me sick and throw up and lose my hair. And I tell my patients that, you know, you got through 20 weeks of chemotherapy, but now the hard work begins. And they're like, what? And I say, the hard work begins. You just have to get up every day and take this pill. And I think that message probably does not necessarily always get out to our patients, because it seems like the hard part is going into the chemotherapy chair, opening up our arm and getting a toxic drug infused through a vein and throwing up and losing our hair. But it's pretty silent once you go into isolation and no one's really watching you to know actually whether you took that pill or not.
Especially for the lengths of time sometimes that these patients have to be on it, and the potential adverse events and side effects too. So it's a great point. So as you know, this is an ACRU podcast. I know you've conducted clinical trials through ACRU. Do you have any studies right now that you're working with through ACRU?
So the most exciting study that we're working on right now just recently activated within ACRU, and it's a neoadjuvant trial in women who have a diagnosis of premenopausal breast cancer. So these are women who are young and they have a diagnosis of estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. And in this trial, what we are doing is comparing a standard of care, which is ovarian function suppression. And ovarian function suppression here typically is an LHRH or a GnRH analog that essentially renders the patient postmenopausal. And we are giving that GnRH analog along with an aromatase inhibitor called exemestane. So that's really a standard of care. It's used commonly across the, not only in the United States, but globally. And we know that utilizing for women who have a diagnosis of ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer, that giving this endocrine approach, of course, leads to better outcomes than some of the older treatments that we did in the past. For example, the drug tamoxifen or tamoxifen plus ovarian function suppression. And so there were some very critical trials that were done in the past, the SOFT and the TEXT trials, and this was confirmed in a recent meta-analysis, essentially showing that you get better breast cancer outcomes when the more you suppress estrogen. And so what we're doing in this trial is we're testing this standard, which is ovarian function suppression and aromatase inhibitor, and we're comparing it to a drug that I've been working on for a while called endoxifen. And what endoxifen is a metabolite of tamoxifen. It's a potent anti-estrogen. But my laboratory and others have demonstrated that this particular drug has a dual mechanism. So not only does it target estrogen receptor alpha, but it also targets PKC beta 1. And we think that these dual effects may lead to greater anti-cancer effects. And one of the things that we're testing in this trial, the primary endpoint is actually 4-week Ki-67. And so what we're doing is we do a biopsy at baseline, we test for Ki-67, And then we do another biopsy at 4 weeks. We recheck Ki-67. And we're really excited about this endpoint. And part of the reason I'm very excited as a clinician is that there are more and more data that essentially show that this short-term endpoint, Ki-67, whether you shut down proliferation, essentially is associated with long-term five-year outcomes. And I think that this is really critical for patients because we tell them, hey, go take this drug for 5 years, but we're not really sure whether it's working or not. We just know that if you give this drug in large clinical trials, that overall there's a 50% reduction in the risk of recurrence, and so go take it. But we don't really know for you whether it's working. So what we have in this now in a number of trials that have essentially validated this endpoint, and that is that 4 weeks, giving a drug for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, and then looking at Ki-67, if you reduce your proliferation rate to less than 10%, your distant disease-free survival at 5 years is outstanding. It's less than 5%. So these patients have a 5-year relapse-free survival rate of 95 to 96%. So it actually turns out that this endpoint of Ki-67 at 4 weeks is a good endpoint to test new drugs. Because if you're testing a new drug and, of course, it's not reducing Ki-67, there's concerns, of course, that particular drug may not work if you study it long-term in a big adjuvant trial where you use 5-year disease-free survival as the outcome. So this is what we're testing in this particular trial.
That's really exciting. And you bring up the point that these early endpoints and the need for new novel endpoints that will get us the answer to our questions faster, I think, is really wonderful. And it sounds like it's an exciting trial for eligible patients. How did you decide to take that through the Accrue Consortium? Was it just kind of the combination of having academic and community sites, or what impacted that decision?
So this trial is actually part of one of our SPORE projects that I co-lead. So the project is entitled Improving the Endocrine Management of Premenopausal Breast Cancer. And as part of that SPORE project, one of the aims is to specifically look at, and we're doing a number of the correlative analysis from this clinical trial. And so as I thought about, okay, what's the best place to run a trial like this, it really, to me, comes down to the fact that it's very important that a trial like this get out to patients out in the community. And I think about many of the Accrue investigators that are out there right now who are really doing some just outstanding work, and the ability, I think, of being out in the trenches, seeing patients, and being able to take what I think is a very important clinical question, and also the ability to get novel drugs out into the community. So Accrue really is a great collaboration, of course, between academic centers like yourself, Kristen at Vanderbilt, and community physicians. And it's that partnership, I think, which is really an outstanding vehicle, outstanding way to get some of these trials not only completed, but also, when we're generating data, it's one thing to generate data in the so-called academic ivory towers, but it's another act to see it actually being generated out really in the real world, which is, of course, where the great majority of all cancer care happens.
And certainly our colleagues in the community, our patients in the community too, are very interested in participating in research and helping lead this effort too. So it's important to be comprehensive in that way. That's one of the things I love about Accrue and my involvement too. So it sounds like with the studies that you've told us about so far, you definitely have been building on many of these ideas and hypotheses and these studies for, sounds like, probably years. And that often is a really kind of how clinical research happens in laboratory medicine too. What have you seen over your career in breast cancer research that you've been really excited about? What's it been like to observe some of the changes? And I've only been out of fellowship for about 10 years now. It'll be 10 years this year. And I can't even believe how much change there's been, even in that amount of time. What have you experienced in the breast cancer world in that regard?
I get goosebumps when I think about this, because there's just been so much change. And and it is overwhelming, I think. But I think back to, I'll tell you, I like to think of it in stories. I think back to about 2002 or 2001, maybe it's a little bit later, but I was just finishing my fellowship at Mayo Clinic. And I remember having a patient that came in and she had a diagnosis of newly diagnosed metastatic breast cancer. And this is a relatively young patient who I remember walking into the room, and there's, you know, like at many academic centers, you have a place for the patient to sit, and it's actually kind of a bench. And she was laying down. She couldn't get up because she was in such severe pain. And so it was one of those moments where you're like, okay, we don't pass go. We don't get $100. We just got to go right to the hospital. This patient needs to be admitted. She needs palliative care, et cetera. So as we were discussing, I was reviewing her chart. I remember at the time thinking, well, this is kind of interesting. She has a diagnosis of HER2 positive breast cancer. And of course, we at that time, trastuzumab actually had just been approved. And as I think about the dates, this might have been 2002, 3, or 4. I can't remember. But I remember as the patient, I was sending her over to the hospital. I said to her, you know, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do much. I said, but you know, there is this drug and it's called Herceptin, and we may want to think about it. So long story short, she went to the hospital. She got her pain managed. I saw her over in the hospital. We ended up, her performance status improved a little bit. We ended up recommending for her to get paclitaxel and Herceptin or trastuzumab. So that was it. No further follow-up. Till about 3 years ago, I got this call out of the blue from this patient. And she said, hey, Dr. Goetz, I'm not sure if you remember me. She said, but I was the patient that you said that there wasn't much more to offer you. And she says, I took Herceptin. And she said, do you think I should stop it? So this was, again, literally like 15 years after that conversation. And so those are the sort of changes that we've seen in breast cancer. Obviously, we're seeing in other cancers as well. Patients where we would say they're not curable, and we're seeing those types of responses. I think the other thing, getting back to your point, when I first came on staff, we had very few tools available, very few drugs available to treat patients. And now the number of new FDA approvals just keeps the number, for example, in breast, just in the last few months, we've had sacituzumab govitecan for ER-positive breast cancer. We've had elacestrant for ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. Of course, the big drug, which was trastuzumab deruxtecan or so-called Enhertu for ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. So these approvals just keep coming, and it's such good news for patients. It's amazing news for our patients.
That's a great patient story. I think we all have similar stories that just kind of keep us going to know that our work in drug development and clinical care really, really impacts patients and families, which of course is our whole goal. But yes, I note, you know, with all these drug approvals, especially since I focus on GI oncology and you know, there are multiple cancer subtypes in there, of course, but realizing how far everything else is changing. I'm doing my board certification, recertification this year. And just looking, when I come across a non-GI question, I'm doing the longitudinal question assessment and just realizing how little I know about some of these drugs. So it's a great thing to have more in our armamentarium to help patients.
I think we're all doing that. I'm just doing my longitudinal assessment right now, and it's pretty sobering what I don't know. So
yes, isn't that true? So what are you excited about moving forward, other than the studies you've told us about and any big upcoming impacts that you think will be coming in the breast cancer world, new drugs coming up or new studies that you're looking forward to hearing about?
Another study that I'm really excited about is a study that I'm involved in utilizing a new drug. It's a new use of an old drug. The drug is called lasofoxifene, and many people who have been in oncology for a while will recall that this drug was actually studied back in the 1990s as a drug that had, I would say, is sort of a women's health type of drug where it improved bone density. It was a selective estrogen receptor modulator, and its biggest competition at that time was tamoxifen. There was data in a big trial called the PEARL study showing that the drug compared to, you know, no treatment had beneficial effects on bone. It also, by the way, substantially reduced the incidence of breast cancer, but it never really got a hold of a sort of a footing in the U.S. because of tamoxifen, which is the sort of the big boy in the room at the time. And it did get some approval in the EU. But the interesting thing about this drug was a few years ago, it was found that this particular drug had some activity against the ESR1 mutated breast cancer. And of course, estrogen receptor mutations are a common problem in ER-positive breast cancer. They occur in 30 to 40% of patients on endocrine therapy, and they drive resistance to endocrine therapy. So lo and behold, this drug, this old SERM, had anti-tumor activity specifically against these ESR1 mutated tumors. And so there's been a couple of trials testing lasofoxifene in metastatic breast cancer. I led one compared to fulvestrant, and there was another trial that was done at MD Anderson combining lasofoxifene with abemaciclib, which is a CDK4/6 inhibitor. But long story short is that this drug looks like it very promising. It basically hits the target. So if you measure ESR1 mutant ctDNA in the circulation, you see it drop, you see clinical benefit, et cetera. So what's happening right now is there's an FDA registration trial combining lasofoxifene with abemaciclib in patients who have endocrine refractory disease who progress on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And the comparator here will be abemaciclib plus fulvestrant. So this is a really exciting time, I think, for as we think about the molecular subtypes. Here's a molecular subtype, a subclonal variant that falls out or comes out after you target patients with endocrine therapy for a while. And it's a major problem that we see clinically. And we have really the first shot across the bow, which was elacestrant, which is a selective estrogen receptor degrader that was just FDA approved. Now we're going to be studying the drug lasofoxifene. There are other SERDs that are coming forward. So really exciting to really address, you know, some of these subvariants, these resistant clones that we've had difficulties, you know, addressing in the past, other than chemotherapy, which my patients really don't want to go on.
Well, that sounds really exciting. Even as a non-breast oncologist, it's really encouraging to hear many of the research angles that are being focused on. What advice would you give to a more junior investigator as they're perhaps developing their career in clinical research? And, you know, that we have a lot of junior investigators and probably many in the audience as well who are always looking for advice, especially from folks who have had very successful careers like yours and continue to. So what would you give as advice to a younger investigator?
It's one of my passions as well. And it really comes down to mentorship, mentorship, mentorship. You have to have the right mentors because it's not all about hard work. We all work hard. You need some breaks along the way. And part of the way you get your breaks is to be mentored. You know, I see a lot of individuals that are working hard that don't have the right mentors. And it's oftentimes not just one mentor. You need multiple mentors. For me, it was really an outstanding world expert in ER-positive breast cancer, which was Dr. Jim Engel, who was my clinical mentor. But I've also had research mentors, Dr. Matt Ames, who was one of my, he was the chair of pharmacology here at Mayo, who I spent my, did my postdoc doctoral work in his laboratory. I've had other, I can name numerous other people that I really look up to. And so identifying mentors is so key because it's really hard to break into the mainstream as just to say, hey, I'm Dr. So-and-so and I work hard and look what I'm doing. You need someone to kind of open up the door for you. But I think even more than that, you need someone that is going to write those letters for you, someone that's going to say your name when you're among others and say, hey, this is Dr. Kristen Siamber, you need to hear about the work that she's doing. It's amazing. That's so critical.
I've been a benefactor too of that kind of mentorship and sponsorship, and it's really wonderful. And makes a huge difference, because you're right, we all work hard, and it helps to also have great role models as well to not only get help from and mentorship, but also to be able to look up to and model our careers after. So thank you for all that you're doing. And then just in the last few minutes, we like to ask a couple of personal questions, kind of to get to know you more outside of research and clinical care. So I was wondering, what are some of your hobbies outside of medicine? I understand you have a degree in music. Do you use that at all? Or what's the backstory there?
I do. I have a, my degree was in actually cello performance. And what happened was, as I was going through and finishing my degree, my future father-in-law said, well, I think you're going to need to support my daughter, and you may need a little bit more than just music here. So I think you should probably go on and do something, you know, that's going to earn a living, you know. And I, by the way, as someone who's a musician, I know that there's a lot of people that are out there working really hard in the music industry, and it's hard. You can certainly make a living, but you're working oftentimes 2, 3, 4 jobs. And so anyway, am I still involved in music? I certainly enjoy it. I have children that play instruments, and so I sort of watch them and hopefully see some of the success that they're having. So that's certainly been something that I've followed over the years.
As a daughter of a music educator, that resonates with me as well. I don't play much anymore, but certainly I think it is a lifelong hobby, whether you play music or enjoy it, or it's a great thing to have. And then, do you have any time to read? What do you like to read? And what book has affected you the most in the last couple of years?
One of the things that I do is, people always ask about, you know, what do you do in your spare time? And I think one of the things that's crazy about being in the position that you and I are in is the type of reading that we have to do in order to keep up on our field is just, it's crazy. And I was thinking about this the other day about what are some of the really good books that I read in the past. One of the books that I always think back that I really enjoyed was a biography about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and what he went through in World War II. Many of you know that he was actually a pastor who was a pacifist. He believed that, you know, one should not get involved in war. And then eventually he was one of these individuals who led a coup against Hitler at the time. And so this was a biography that was written, and I'm blanking on the name of the author right now, but it was something that I just really enjoyed reading and would certainly recommend it to anybody.
I've been meaning to read more about Bonhoeffer. I've read little bits and pieces, just from a kind of religious background and interest, but historically, yeah, really, really an interesting person and someone who impacted the world quite a bit. So thank you so much for joining me today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for spending time, giving us your insight. And thank you too to our listeners, and hope to join you next time. Thank you.